Hello, and welcome to the Innovation in Financial Inclusion podcast, focusing on innovative and emerging practice in financial inclusion. I'm Paul Vick from Community Finance Solutions at the University of Salford, a research unit specializing in financial inclusion and community finance. Over the past four episodes, we have talked about the policy objectives and impact of financial education, teaching financial literacy to children and young people, and how financial education is delivered in the workplace and out in local communities. In this final episode, I'll be taking stock of the state of financial education and exploring what it should look like in the future with Quentin Nason. Quentin is a finance professional with over 30 years of experience from investment banking and asset management and founder of City Pay It Forward, a UK charity that partners with schools to teach students the basics in financial literacy. Quentin, what can you tell me about the state of financial education today? Where do you think the gaps are? What do you think is well covered?
Well, I think just in terms of our work, we do it in two geographies. We do it in the UK mostly, but we also do some work in the United States just because I spend time in both. And I think it's interesting to compare and contrast a little bit because there's similar markets and education systems, but actually they differ. In neither market or educational system is financial literacy required. And I think that that's a very important thing because the school day is very full, and schools and educators and administrators have to figure how to allocate their time. And obviously schools are not only a place for education, but there are also a lot of societal things come through, whether they're behavioral or nutrition or well-being or health and safety and the like. So it's very, very crowded. So time is scarce. And obviously the focus is on what's statutory. So that means the non-statutory materials and subjects it's a very competed slot. And financial literacy falls into that space, number one. And in the UK, it falls within the PSHE curriculum, which is a broad church and includes all sorts of different subjects. I think one of the things that we have found, research has found, a lot of reports have been put on, is that financial literacy is that one subject that teachers lack confidence in giving. You could sort of, without a whole lot of preparation, maybe talk about nutrition or well-being or some of the other subjects. But financial literacy is one that if you're a 23-year-old NQT, you sort of can't just sort of make it up on the go. The other thing that's interesting is there's not that much materials just off the shelf. So let's say you are a teacher and say, I want to, within PSHE, embark on giving financial literacy, let's say, to a year six student. There's really not stuff necessarily easily available off the shelf. And I think that makes it more complicated. So it's not statutory. It competes for a lot of against a lot of other things in the school day. And teachers don't feel confident, or it's not something that's easily approachable, and there's not something for them to just pick up and go. So I would say that encapsulates what we're finding in UK. It's not dissimilar in the US.
Given that you have this US-UK, what would you say are some of the key differences between those two settings?
The US is interesting because it has a top-down approach, in the sense that as with City Pay It Forward, we're always trying to find ways to engage with more schools, more teachers. And the question is, how do you do that? Is there an organization that has a lot of schools? Can you go on a national basis? Can you go to a local authority? So we're always trying to find, if you like, those pinch points or those multipliers. And the reality is in the UK, it's much more fragmented. There's 21,000 primary schools, and you almost have to engage with 21,000 different schools. It's different in the U.S. in the sense that you have state by state and school district by school district. It's much more of a top-down approach. You have a superintendent of a school district. They obviously work with the statutory subjects, but each one has, let's say, a maths department or a social studies department. And as long as there's links to the statutory subjects, you're able to sort of push down top down. I think that that's the way we've been able to work in two out of the three large school districts, namely Miami-Dade and Los Angeles, because we've been able to collaborate with the math departments, and they've then therefore have been putting it on to what they call the pacing guide. And then the pacing guide is what is a, you know, drives a day for teachers. So the US is a little bit easier for non-statutory subjects because there's the ability to push it down top down, versus in the UK it's much more fragmented.
Well, that's interesting. Now, when you go out and visit schools, whether that's in America or in the UK, and those schools that are able to actually find some time in the day to do some financial education, when you look at what they're delivering, you said something about problems, but what do you think is actually covered quite well or works really well?
That's an interesting question. I don't think it's really covered sort of at all. And the question is, who is going to do that in-class intervention? Will it be a teacher? And if so, which teacher? What might it be? Would it be a maths teacher? Will it be a PSAT teacher? Will it be some other subject? Will it be a volunteer from an organization or a charity like ourselves? So I think the first question is, who is going to deliver it? And then the second question is, well, what are they going to deliver? And the third question is, how often will they deliver it? So, you know, there are organizations, including ourselves, that go to schools that when we deliver materials, so we deliver our own materials. And I think our materials have been based on a lot of empirical research, our interactions with students, stuff that we find engaging and impactful. If it's a teacher doing it, then the question is, where might they pull their materials? And there are materials for them to pull from different organizations. Some financial institutions also provide it. But I believe a really important thing is teaching the teachers or training the trainers, because they don't feel comfortable necessarily doing it. And just picking it up and presenting it, I think is missing something. So it's hard, because that is one of the things that leads to fragmentation of provisioning, is who does it and what do they do it and what training might they have. And the reality is it's very, you know, case by case or spotty, if you like.
And you mentioned there that education that you deliver as part of your organization's work is founded on empirical research or empirical research around what works. And can you highlight some of the things that you definitely, that you know works well? What are some of those ingredients?
It's really interesting, because I think traditionally you think financial literacy should be maths based, in the sense that, you know, a lot of it is counting coins or calculating interest, or it's some link to math. And generally, especially in this case, in the United States, it comes through the math subject vertical. But the reality is we find that these days children don't touch money, so they don't count coins. And for a long time, we had near zero interest rates, so there wasn't a whole lot of calculation to do. We find that financial literacy today is about behavioral economics. It's about trade-offs and making educated decisions and researching and determining whether you're going to go this course of action or that course of action. So we spend a lot of time finding ways to empower children and young people to be able to make those decisions when they're faced with a choice. How do they assess one side versus other? For example, to buy something that's generic or something that's a brand. How do you enter into that? And the reality is kids really engage with that. They understand that. They understand the concepts of trade-offs. So that's where we spend a lot of time. And I think it's different, because traditionally, and a lot of the materials are very dry because they go into, hey, you know, let's do a calculation. And I think we take a different approach. And I think it's the benefit of having created a curriculum from scratch recently. And it's also based on our interactions with children. You know, I mean, we see what works, what hooks, what's engaging, what's impactful, and then we put that into our materials.
Yeah, I think that's interesting and chimes with some of the other guests I've been talking with about enabling, putting people in a position where they can make some, you know, where they can make some informed financial decisions and giving them those tools. I was also interested by what you said around the digital and sort of the disappearance of cash in a way, which I think you alluded to, because Russell Winard from Young Enterprise also highlighted that that's one of the challenges when you're teaching it, is that, you know, given that a lot of kids now might not even see or handle cash, and cash is such a, you know, it's a visible indicator of what you've just spent and what you have left. So it's quite a visual cue in that sense. Is there anything in terms of how you, does that have some implications for delivering financial education, do you think?
Absolutely. When you and I were growing up and we went to the corner store, there was a lot of actions involved in that. You know, you took the money out of the drawer, put it in your pocket, walked down the street, identified it, you pulled the money out, you bought it, you took count the coins, you put the money back in your pocket, and off you went. Now, literally, you know, a child who will statistically have a smartphone by 10.3 years old, will have a debit card at the age of 11, go to a store, tap, and off they go. The contactless limit is £100, which is a lot of money for 11 years old. They never touch money. And I think that they're developing a very abstract relationship with money. And it is very easy to spend when it does. It just doesn't feel real if you don't touch it, I believe. And if you look at some of the online retailers, there's these buy now buttons. I mean, there is no physical interaction, you know, in terms of I want to buy it and actually buying it. And that's very important to us. So, for example, we spend some time talking about the 24-hour rule. You know, wait 24 hours between I want to buy something and actually buying it, because what it does is it interjects time, it interjects action, and in doing so, it really breaks that process between that instant purchasing, that instant gratification. So we spend a lot of time on things like that, but to us, that's fundamental. You know, this whole cashless society and how you teach children to make these decisions is a big decision tree.
And I think it also chimes with some of the literature around that shows that when people use debit cards, credit cards, or digital payments, they are more prone to overspend and less likely to accurately recall what they've spent. So I think that sort of feeds into some of those things. And looking into the crystal ball and looking forward, do you think, are there any trends or anything that you think we'll see more of going forward in terms of financial education?
Well, I think one of the things that that worries me a little bit, especially is you know, been a banker for 20 years, is, you know, we asked children a question as we were going around talking about savings and opening up a bank account. And we just start to ask the question, do they feel that their money's safe in the bank? And, you know, we've done that question to about 20,000 students, 11-year-olds, broad demographics. And I might ask you, when we ask the children, is your money safe in the bank? What percentage of those children say, yes, my money's safe in the bank?
My immediate thought would be that it would be very high, because you think that banks are sort of this image of, you know, solidity of and reliability, but maybe if you're born after the financial crash of 2007, it might be lower. But yeah, a hazard guess, maybe I'll say 60% say that it's safe.
Well, we're finding, surprisingly, that only 25 to 50% say that their money is safe. And that's, if you stop and think about it, is that means the vast majority of the children that we ask that question to do not feel that their money's safe in the bank. And the financial system is one that's based on trust. And obviously there's, you know, it's covered by the, you know, the protection scheme of the government up to £85,000. So we spend a lot of time trying to tell children that their money is in fact safe and the financial system is safe, because they're not really going to be incentivized to open up a savings account if they don't feel. And this is a subject for a lot more research. This is just our experience with children, but these are the kind of things that it's really important to weave into financial literacy education in the future, because these are these trends that are coming. You know, what worked 10 years ago or 15 years ago doesn't work today. And so these longitudinal research studies are important. This research, a lot of that you and your colleagues are doing and Adele's doing is super important, because it will educate us as to how we create these materials today.
Yeah, so empirical and academic research, I always agree, is obviously an important element to all this. So can you think, is there sort of a good example of what you think is an innovative, forward-looking financial education, something you perhaps seen somewhere, or a particular part of what you deliver that you think is sort of quite forward-looking that others could be looking to replicate perhaps?
I think there's a few things. You know, I think our financial literacy education approach is a little bit different since we've created it from scratch. Is one, we believe to weave in concepts of entrepreneurship. So if a child goes into a coffee shop, they can go buy the muffins and leave. But we tell them, no, actually, look at a coffee shop as a business. Is it a good business? How do they make their money? What are their expenses? Do they have, you know, good price points? Do they, you know, are the customers happy? Children understand, especially they understand often the language of entrepreneurship. So that's, we empower them by doing that. And it really locks in. So that's one of the things that you see, that little glimmer in the eye, because children understand that. The second thing we say is, if you want to affect changes in society, one of the most powerful tools is the wallet. And nowadays, children organize very quickly. And so if they do their research and they find out that, say, that retailer does good for the environment or does good for, you know, their employees, they can reward them by going to that shop. But if they find out that a competitor is not equally committed to social change, they can vote to go to one versus the other, and they will affect change, because obviously, companies want customers and that will attract them. So we tell children that they are empowered to make change in society by where they custom, where they spend their money, and children like that a lot. So we weave in these concepts that are maybe a little bit more tangential, you'd say, in financial literacy, but we see that really engages them.
I guess that's the key challenge. How do you get people to engage with it and take it on? Because it can potentially be, it sounds very like a very, very dry topic. So in terms of, if you had the ear of the schools and potentially of a minister or someone who had influence to change something about financial education, what would be sort of the one or two things that you'd like to see changed?
I think everybody really is clamoring for trying to make financial literacy education statutory, because the only way that you're able to get it into the crowded school day is to make it one of the core things that a school needs to do. So now Wisconsin just became the 24th state in the United States to mandate financial literacy education to graduate from high school. So that means half of the states in the United States now require financial literacy. And I think in due course, probably all 50 states. We need that to happen also in the UK. But it's not just making financial literacy education statutory. That's a magic wand. We also need to weave it into the Ofsted manual, where there today is no mention whatsoever of any form of financial literacy or economic. So we need to weave it in there. We need to also find ways to train teachers in the subject matter. And the last thing I'll say, which is a big move, we have to try to find ways to empower parents to talk about this at home, because we have to approach it in a multiple ways. And school is the easy answer, but it's not the complete answer. And I think we need to recognize that.
Well, that was a very interesting conversation with Quentin. I was especially interested in learning about the difference between how financial education is delivered in the US versus the UK. For me, four things stood out. The first one is that the delivery of financial education in the UK is currently hindered by the fact that it's not statutory. So it has to compete with lots of other things in the crowded curriculum. It also means that the delivery is fragmented and uneven across the country, unlike in the US, where financial education is more coordinated on the state level. And teachers often also lack the confidence to teach it. Secondly, although financial education quite often is bundled in with maths, it's actually less about calculation and more about understanding the trade-offs associated with different decisions so that you can help people make educated choices. The third thing I thought was interesting is that the way people are managing their finances is changing because of the disappearance of cash and the movement to digital payments and digital money management. And digital payments are traditionally less transparent and tangible, and you may be at greater risk of overspending. So financial education needs to build in the skills and give people the tools to manage their money digitally. So for example, Quentin suggested this idea of a 24-hour rule, that you impose a 24-hour cooling off period on yourself before making a payment. That's one example of those type of tools. Finally, financial education in the future will need to address this falling levels of trust in the financial system. Quentin mentioned that somewhere between 25 to 50% of the students they talk with say that or believe that their money is safe in banks. So they clearly are unaware of some of the basic safeguards that exist in the system, such as deposit protection. And that sort of information is obviously key to make informed decisions about what to do with our money and how to spend it and how to keep it safe. And that's it for the Innovation in Financial Inclusion podcast with me, Paul. That was the final episode of the series. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with another series very soon, so do stay tuned. If you want to find out more or contribute to the discussion, go to hub.salford.ac.uk/CFS or follow us on Twitter @CFS_SBS. Bye for now.